Welcome to Breaking Free Podcast, your recovery, your way. I'm Tiffany.
And I'm Liv. You're in the right place if you want to explore what it means to be in recovery, to challenge the things that keep us small, and to learn how to thrive independently.
Together we are breaking free. Just a quick reminder that while I'm a nurse and a coach, and Liv is a coach, recovery advocate, and a writer, we are not doctors. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you need to, please, please see a doctor.
The Alana Club of Portland is proud to sponsor the Breaking Free podcast. Your recovery, your way, is at the heart of our approach to recovery support services.
Unity Recovery, an inclusive recovery community organization serving all of Philadelphia, is proud to support the Breaking Free podcast. Recovery is possible. Find your path to break free.
Hello, everybody. Today, we're going to shine a light on all of the questions, concerns, and fears you may have, and we have, around 12-step recovery. The ultimate question is 12-step recovery right for me? So we recognize that each person has their own path, their own journey, and we want to honor that. So we're going to really explore, and Liv's done a lot of work around this. She's a writer. She has highlighted whether 12-step is, you know, helpful or not in some of her writing, and really zoned in on some of the things that are concerning in the 12-step community. So let's dive in. Liv, what's your experience been with maybe questioning 12-step?
Oh my gosh. This took probably, I started questioning around the 2-year mark. Mm-hmm. You know, there were concerns that popped up and I quickly pushed them back down, as Brits are really good at repressing emotions. So, of course, like in the early days, well, not just in the early days, you're taught that you can't trust your thinking. Mm-hmm. So I had just put it down to that, and I'd also ignored aspects that, you know, were concerning me. And I just thought, well, I'll just put this to one side. I've committed to doing this. I'm going to dig in. And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I would sit in meetings, I would hear all of these aspects where I'd think, oh, yeah, that's not working for me. And the more I tried to press it down, the more it came up. Mm. So I just started to explore what these concerns were by interviewing other people, finding out what their recovery looks like. Mm. And
you did this as part of your blog, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, because I've got a really curious nature, which I love about myself, and can sometimes...
Curiosity killed the cat.
Right. So I think in essence, you know, and we talked about this in one of the other podcasts, is to really look at what the landscape of recovery is. Mm. Right? And it's not what I was shown, which was this is 12-step is the only way, and to think about other options means one thing. You know, you're headed in one direction. Mm. In many ways, I've been watching a lot of programs this week on religions and cults.
And religions and cults.
Yeah. And I'm not suggesting that AA is a cult, although many people might say that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go down that road. Mm-hmm. For me, like we've said in other episodes, we have, and I'm sure I speak for Tiffany here, we have a deep respect for people and all pathways of recovery. If that is 12-step, we deeply respect you. What we want to do as part of this podcast is to have critical discourse, which, you know, opens the opportunity for us to have challenging conversations, but also, you know, give light to the concerns that people already have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I think it draws... It's not a cult, but it does draw a lot of parallels from a closed family unit. Mm. And what a closed family unit looks like is everybody has their role. And there's usually one person that has a role that the family can manipulate. And if that person is to challenge the parameters of that role in any way, or to want to seek to step outside of their role, then they're shunned and they're shamed. And I think... You know, our friend Veronica says that the AA is ancient spiritual wisdom, and I think she's right. Yeah. A lot of the problem with 12 steps, it isn't the 12 steps themselves, although there are aspects of that that I don't align with. It's more the fellowship and the interpretation over the years which has become misconstrued. So, you know, there are aspects where it says, you know, many have we seen people that have followed up. Rarely have we seen a person that has thoroughly followed this path, you know, that paragraph in the big book. And ultimately, it's suggesting that if this program doesn't work for someone, it's because they've not been honest, not being completely honest with themselves. And I think for me, that's potentially harmful because it shames. You know, if somebody has returned to use and we're telling them that they've not been honest with themselves, then it doesn't really keep the hand of recovery there for them. It tells them that they're not working hard enough. It tells them that there's something wrong with them. And I don't want that for people. I want there always to be a hand of recovery there, because I believe that we all have, we all deserve to recover. So yeah, that is I feel is a little bit fear-mongering, you know, that leaving means returning to use. The other aspect that I don't like is the idea that we have this monster living inside of our brains. You know, I've heard many a phrase, I don't know if you say this in America, but in England, I'd heard in NA meetings, you know, that's your disease talking, or that your addict is sitting in the car park doing push-ups waiting for you to mess up. I don't want to split my mind into two different personalities and believe that I have a monster living inside of me. I feel that in order for me to recover, that I need to regain trust in myself, that I need to be able to tap into what my intuition is telling me. That is not to say that I don't believe that something chemically changes within my brain when I take a drink or a drug and I lose the ability, the power of choice. I do believe that, but I don't believe I have a monster inside my brain. Do you want to say anything about those aspects?
Yeah, I think my number one concern and the reason that I left was the fear-mongering piece and the concept of we're broken, that we're never going to be okay. And yeah, the it's your disease talking. Even, you know, when I decided to leave 12 step, I let some people know who were important to me, and I talked about why. And you know, I've been sober for over 20 years. And
she doesn't look that old.
And I had people say, like, you need to be careful. And, you know, that's, you know, could be your addict or your disease talking. And this is something I put a lot of careful thought into. And if you listen to our Essentials of Recovery episode, I think that was episode 3. The, you know, it's. There are so many things I do to support my recovery and for my own personal growth and development. Essentials of Recovery is episode 3. We found it. So, you know, you're welcome to listen to that. But the point is that I have really done a ton of healing. I am, you know, I'm a nurse. I'm a parent. There are so many areas of my life that I have managed myself well, and that I can, you know, regularly manage myself well, and yet to be told that there's this part of you where you can't trust yourself. I think that there's reasons that they, you know, that they, that that's ingrained in the culture, because when we first come in, a lot of times we really don't know what to do, and we really have broken trust with ourselves, and we really do want to rationalize, and we want to justify, and we want to make excuses for not going, and because we want to go, you know, we want to go have a drink, right? Like, so there is that piece of it, but that doesn't mean that you can't come to a place in your life where you can trust yourself. And like you said, rebuilding trust is really important. So to be told that we're not capable of that, or to be told that, that you can never trust yourself and you always need to run your thoughts by someone else first. And don't get me wrong. I mean, when I have a big decision to make, I talk to people in my life about it that I trust. But ultimately, I trust that I'm able to make a good decision for me in my life today. So that was my biggest concern as well. So I'm glad that you brought that piece up.
And I think that's the aspect that's missing for me is the development of self, you know, is because independent thought is shunned. it therefore creates dependence on the fellowship, that you can't do anything without checking. You know, I was told, before you make a decision, check it out with three people. Mm-hmm. And while that might be helpful initially, because we are emotionally stunted, our thinking hasn't necessarily been right, but once we recover the ability to think for ourselves, mm-hmm. that should be encouraged. An identity should be encouraged. Mm-hmm. Life beyond sitting in a church basement should be encouraged. Mm-hmm. And that's my belief. And, you know, in order to recover from trauma, you need to develop agency and autonomy. And if you are dependent on other people's opinion before you make a decision, that's not agency or autonomy. Mm-hmm. So how could you make decisions in other areas of your life? If you look back at AA's original purpose, it was supposed to be a bridge to normal living. So it's not a bridge to normal living if you have to call three people to make a decision.
Yeah, we have to make decisions all day long. Right? You should see the number of decisions Liv and I have had to make about this podcast alone, let alone our businesses.
Yeah. Adulting.
Yeah, right? Totally.
There should be a step on adulting.
Yeah.
And speaking of steps, that the point you made about looking at ourselves as broken and defective, that speaks to me deeply. Mm. You know, I don't want to spend my evenings doing a step 10 looking at where my character defects have been present in my life, because, you know, there are so many different factors at play, and it isn't necessarily, well, I understand that we need to keep our side of the street clean, and it's a helpful exercise if there is a challenging situation to look at, oh, hey, what's going on within me? I think that's a really helpful thing. Mm-hmm. But to say, oh, well, this defect isn't working for me, it just reinforces that low self-esteem.
Yeah, I don't like the word defect. I wish that there was, I mean, you know, the moral inventory, okay, you know, but the assets and defects, to me, they are just different aspects of our personality, and some of them can make it challenging in other relationships, right? So it's more challenges than it is defects to me, because there's no part of me is defective.
No, but also, you know, where does psychology come into this? Because, you know, people that have substance use disorder have, generally speaking, I mean, Gabor Maté, the well-known addiction psychiatrist, said that, you know, up to 90% of people that have substance use disorder have had trauma. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have the ACE study also, if you haven't heard of it, the ACE test. We'll talk about this on a much further episode. But
adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah, go check out that scoring. See where you're at, because it's really informative.
Right. And so, you know, when we're talking about the psychology of trauma and addiction, without a trained psychologist, to label something as defective from an untrained perspective is potentially very damaging. You know, for me, I have complex PTSD, so there are aspects of my personality and the traits in my behaviors that may seem out of character or outside of the norm, but that's because I'm hypervigilant in certain states, because my PTSD is activated. Mm-hmm. So to say to somebody, oh, well, you're, you know, acting defective in this way, is not looking at the underlying reason for that, of I don't feel safe in my body or in this particular situation. To put that on me, you know, as something defective within me is quite harmful, that instead of to look at what happened to you, why the pain, mm-hmm. you know, like Gabor Maté says, not why the addiction, but why the pain, mm-hmm. you know, we need to look at the heart of our trauma and really get to some healing. You know, this is not a surface level condition.
Yeah. There's, I mean, even if someone had a childhood that was, you know, roses and butterfly,
unicorn shitting rainbows.
Yeah. Even if we, you know, had the quote unquote perfect childhood, there are still things that are going to, you know, we're still going to be affected by being harmed in our lives. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons that we're wanting to numb out. Right.
Yeah.
And so really, I agree. I think having some distance from those things, that can be helpful. But then really getting down to the causes and conditions and the underlying causes, like you're talking about, for the pain in the first place, the reasons mm-hmm. that we're wanting to numb out, whether it be physical, emotional,
yeah,
mental.
And you know, going back to our earlier point as well, I wanted to add that, you know, when we're shaming people for the program not working for them, you know, and instead of saying the problem is you, like, let's look at the big picture. There are 88,000 people a year dying from alcohol use disorder and 66,000 from substance use disorder. Yeah,
that's an incredibly huge number.
Right. Yeah. Shaming them is not going to address the problem. So that's really harmful. Mm-hmm. And I'm in no way saying that AA is responsible for those deaths. Mm-hmm. Not at all. But what I'm saying is, if we are telling someone that it's their level of honesty that's the issue for AA not working, mm-hmm. that's a problem.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a pause here so that we can hear from our awesome sponsors.
The Alana Club of Portland is proud to sponsor the Breaking Free podcast. Your recovery, your way, is at the heart of our approach to recovery support services. As the largest and most diversely programmed non-clinical recovery support center in the United States, we've been proudly breaking barriers and forging new pathways for years to ensure everyone has a home in recovery. From peer mentoring to recovery CrossFit, from trauma-informed yoga to mindfulness training, the Alana Club of Portland has a recovery pathway that's right for you.
Here at Unity Recovery, we believe recovery should be the expectation, not the exception. Whether you find support with mutual aid, harm reduction, medication, or yoga, your recovery is beautiful and worth celebrating. Learn more and become part of the recovery movement at unityrecovery.org.
And we're back. Yeah, I think that's something too that, you know, it's hard to know what they meant exactly by that. I think, you know, the part, people who have thoroughly followed our path, right? So, you know, I think they were maybe alluding to the idea that some people haven't actually really shown up or haven't, you know, done personal growth and development work or haven't really been committed to the process. But that's different than you're defective, which is kind of more where we've, you know, or you didn't work hard enough, right?
Yes.
So certainly if you come in and, you know, to any path of recovery and you don't do deeper work on yourself, it's going to be really challenging to maintain that pathway of recovery.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a different thing. That's that willingness factor that we talked about last episode a little bit, taking action. And at that time, they didn't understand different, you know, mental health diagnoses and these things, right? So the unable to be honest with themselves, like, they may have been referring to someone who has a mental health diagnosis that causes them not to be able to, you know, thoroughly look at these things. I don't know.
Or an agnostic who doesn't want to believe in God.
Yeah. So at that time, our understanding of things were really different. So one of the things I do like about the program is it's been around for a really long time, so you can rely on it, right? But there are things that we've brought forward. Our culture has changed and also our understanding has deepened and shifted, but we haven't necessarily brought that into the rooms.
No.
Like you were saying, the current understanding in psychology isn't really thoroughly applied.
No. And also the way in which we use alcohol and drugs has changed, right? In 1939, I'd imagine very few people use drugs. So, you know, in England, I mean, get this, in England, if you go to an AA meeting and identify as someone with substance use disorder, you're told you're in the wrong fellowship.
That's a shame.
It's a real shame because it tells people that there is not a hand of recovery there for them. Like, the only requirement for membership is the desire, right? Mm-hmm. And they, you know, I have, let's just say, close people in my world that believe that those people should not be in the rooms. And I deeply disagree. I think that anybody that is seeking recovery and seeking help in the rooms of AA, NA, whatever, they are using a substance to harm themselves.
Yeah.
They should be welcomed with open arms, not told to shut up. You know, there have been meetings where people have been told to stop speaking because they're talking about a drug.
Yeah, that's really a shame. For me personally, I came into the program, I kind of came to my knees, so to speak, primarily because of substance use and amphetamines in particular.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tried to go to NA meetings, and the NA meetings that I experienced here, were, you know, there was a lot of people like pacing around the rooms.
Yeah.
There was just a whole different energy to it. Yeah. And it didn't work for me. And so I felt really uncomfortable. And so I went primarily to AA, but I was abstaining from alcohol, but I didn't actually believe I was an alcoholic for at least the first year.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even 21 yet. And I thought, you know, when I turn 21 or, you know, some point, you know, I couldn't imagine like having a wedding without alcohol. So I figured at some point I would return to drinking.
Yeah.
I started to kind of believe like, yes, it was more about my relationship to alcohol that was the problem than how much I actually drank. I just didn't have that much access.
Yeah.
But when I did have access, you know, all bets were off. But I thought, oh, maybe it was just part of being young. So it took me a long time to even come to that belief. And when I quit smoking, actually, I was like, this is what it felt like for me. This is how I feel about alcohol, like how I feel about cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And so then I was able to be like, oh, this is really a problem for me. But if it had been at the meetings I'd been at had been hard and fast, you can't talk about, you know, drug use, that doesn't qualify you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been around.
Yeah.
So I do agree with you that really can be excluding and harmful. And it's really a shame that happens still today.
It really is. So speaking of coming to your knees and the process of surrender, like steps one and two, the powerlessness and the surrender, that process in itself, even though it is disempowering, it's considered to be empowering to surrender, right? Mm-hmm. But actually, you know, the belief that I am powerless and that I need the help of something greater than me to solve that problem, I think I no longer align with, you know. I choose today, I do not take a drink or a drug because I choose not to. Mm-hmm. It's not because I've surrendered my will to God or that someone has saved me. It's because I no longer want that for my life. My life is so big and so amazing, not all the time. I am trying to buy a house, folks. It's exhausting. But you know, today I have the ability to do that, right?
Yeah.
So for me, the power of choice has returned. I no longer believe that I'm powerless. I believe that if I take a drink or a drug, that I do lose the power of choice. So it's a bit of an interesting. Mm-hmm.
I feel like so many people really struggle with this. It's interesting now that we're recording this and I'm starting to talk with people in the world that I encounter about this podcast. It comes up, you know, I'll say, oh yeah, we're recording a podcast. I almost always someone says, yeah, that the powerless piece didn't work for me.
Yeah.
Or I don't believe that I have to surrender to something else. People feel really vehemently, you know, strongly about this, that is disempowering, right? For me, I felt the thing that you described at the beginning, like it felt like I had a lot of shame, but that felt like personal shame that I already had. It didn't feel like that part of the process was shaming, and that there was some relief in this. But I agree with you too that now I'm in a place where I don't feel powerless over it. I don't actually, there's very little that I feel powerless over, but I still do want to turn my will over to higher power because I feel like life just is easier that way. Like I don't have to feel like I'm, you know, because for me it's a control thing, right? Yeah. Like I try to control outcomes sometimes and that doesn't feel good to me. So, but I can see what you're talking about and I hear it from people all of the time. And I do believe that many people feel that is really disempowering and that they could never do that. And that doesn't have anything to do with the piece that you're talking about from the book about their honesty level.
Yeah.
It's simply their belief system and their values.
Yeah.
So, So I love that you bring that point up.
Yeah. I really struggle with it. I think it's something that I still am an hour about, you know, I don't believe I'm powerless in my life. Although I do believe I'm powerless over other people. Mm-hmm. You know, I have no control, but I do have control over the steps that I take and the behavior that I.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like when I first got sober or came into the program, that I did feel powerless over it. Yeah. I felt like something that I felt like I might just fall into a drink, right? Or like I might just like find myself doing some drugs, right?
But this is the thing, like I have, without revealing the identity of these people, I have people close to me who have said, I worry that I'm going to go and have a drink after over 10 years of recovery. And, you know, I don't know if that's going to have, you know, if that's going to happen. And even if you look at the big book, they call alcohol king alcohol, right? Mm. So it's this big bad demon that might jump into your mouth, you know, like the wine's going to jump off the shelf in the grocery store and down your neck, right?
Yeah, I think it's a tough thing because I can relate to that when it comes to cigarettes. Like, there are a handful of reasons I don't smoke, but I loved it so much. And it feels so benign sometimes. And it feels like, well, you know, if I had a cigarette, like I have that kind of tricky part of my brain when it comes to cigarettes. And so I can relate on some level. And it did take me a number of years before I started feeling really solid and that I wouldn't just accidentally have a drink or accidentally or just kind of on a whim decide to for me, you know, I had children, I had a career that could have been affected by it, I had all of these things. And so it really felt like if I were to drink or use that I would be putting those things at jeopardy because I know how I behave when I do those things. I don't moderate well. So it felt scary for a really long time, but I do feel like the program perpetuates that.
Yeah.
You know,
because the thoughts are normal, right? The thoughts, and I think it perpetuates the belief that these are like bad thoughts and that if we're having them, that there's something wrong. Mm. I don't think that there is. I think, you know, I was able to explain, like, I still have thoughts. Mm-hmm. You know, I still have thoughts that I want to go back to my ex. But when I play that through, right, it's a drug. Yeah. It's still a drug, right? If I play it through, I take a moment to go, okay, I don't need to be afraid of that thought anymore. Mm-hmm. Yes, this is showing me, this is my barometer of there being something off, right? Mm. That my stress levels are a little bit too high. I know, like, my ex is my best spiritual barometer. When I find myself on their Instagram profile, I know that I'm really stressed out and that I need to take a step back.
Yeah.
So it's the same with alcohol or with smoking, right? And I do know, I play the story through, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a helpful, empowering exercise. It's not that we need to be frightened of our thoughts anymore.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's definitely important to be able to embrace all aspects of ourselves. And one thing that I've learned recently at a conference about speaking was that if we avoid something, if we feel like something is scary or too challenging or whatever, that we're actually more likely to perpetuate behavior around it. And so by allowing to rewarding awareness of those thoughts and those feelings, we actually can have a greater impact on the change. Like, we have.
Do you know what you're doing while you're saying that? You're touching your shoulder.
I'm petting myself, guys.
But it's a really lovely thing. Tiffany tells me so much about. She shows me so much about how to be kind to myself and my body. You guys. No, we're trying not to say you guys.
Everybody. Folks.
Everybody, honeys.
Honey.
Hey, honeys. So she's touching her shoulder and she's petting herself and it's really lovely. I think we should all do that.
Thank you. Yeah, this was modeled to me years ago by a therapist who's a really incredible person. Yeah, and it felt so loving and she would encourage us to do that. Just give ourselves a little bit of a squeeze or just put our hand, you know. Thank you. I agree. I think that there's of course the stigmatizing terms and language around that, which we're going to have an episode on exclusively. But but I think the overall theme for today is really this idea that the messages that we receive can be harmful. It's not so much the program itself, although that closed system, I think that's part of why those things are perpetuated, right? Yeah. There's not a lot of outside influence coming in.
No.
And that's unfortunate because the pieces that cause people to not be able to utilize 12-step meetings,
they're multifactorial.
Yeah, and we're not able to change it if we just have this closed system and we're just avoiding thinking about it, and if we just kind of all have this group think about it. So that's why we really wanted to bring this episode forward and really question, hey, are these are aspects that might not be working for you.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when we leave the program, I've had this experience pretty, not entirely, but I've been on the other side of this as well. When people have left, we're kind of cut off.
Yeah.
And it's like people are afraid it's going to catch.
Yeah.
Like you're.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. You represent.
You're contagious.
Yeah. You represent a threat to their recovery.
Yeah.
And that's, you lose friendships.
Yeah. And which is really sad because people still need that support and they would still benefit. I do today have friends, a few friends who are in the program, and it is helpful to me to still connect with them.
Yeah.
And I think I also feel like it may be helpful from their perspective to see me modeling that it is possible to bring in these other aspects of recovery and still thrive.
Yeah. And that was a really important reason why we wanted to have this podcast, is to show that it's to show exactly that, you know, that we exist, right? That's why I set up the Facebook group Life After AA, mm-hmm. you know, Life After 12 Steps, because I wanted to show that we exist, and that the myth that to leave means one thing, returning to use, is not true. Mm-hmm. And actually shaming people for leaving might push them towards using again.
Yeah, you know? I feel like there's people in my life that ended up returning to use as a means of leaving the program.
I want to encourage people that if you do have concerns or questions about whether or not it's the right AA, NA, whatever 12-step fellowship is the right fit for you, is to honor those concerns, to look into them. You know, you don't have to make any big changes, but you can reach out in various groups. You can have conversations. You can listen to this podcast. We will answer any questions that we get. We do have a Breaking Free community on Facebook for you to reach out in. I also have the Facebook group, Life After 12-Step Recovery. We just want to give you permission to honor those concerns.
Yeah, question away. We're here to support you and know that it is possible to thrive outside of 12-step. It's possible to thrive with 12-step and other other pathways of recovery all blended into one, if that's what works for you. And it is doable.
Yeah.
So know that there are other options out there for you.
Yeah, and I really want to instill the confidence to trust those concerns. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't necessarily need to listen to other people telling you that you cannot trust your instincts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do some, you know, quiet reflective time. Take some time with yourself. See if that's really your truth. And if it is, we want to encourage you to honor that, because having a strong sense of what, you know, of agency and autonomy is really valuable. And we both experienced it. And it not only does it help us personally to have those, but modeling that has been helpful to the people in our lives. Yeah. And it allows us to walk through life without, you know, with less judgment and with more ease, because we can honor our own decisions. We can honor each other's decisions and know that, you know, you have reasons for your choices.
Yeah.
And that's okay. It doesn't mean there's no right or wrong way to do recovery.
No, I think that's crucial.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining today. And next, we're so lucky we get to hear Liv's story. So make sure you join us next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Breaking Free Podcast, Your Recovery, Your Way.
We want to hear from you.
Email us at hello@breakingfreerecovery.com or join our Facebook group, Breaking Free Community.
Tell us what Breaking Free means to you.